I've always had, or until I met the movement, I'd always had this sense that I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. A sense that I didn't quite fit in. It was as if I'd been time travelling and got stuck in 20th century East London by mistake. Almost as well as if I was an orphan who'd been adopted by my family. I mean, I often found myself when I was quite young thinking, what am I doing with these people? By the time I was about 14, I had the idea that if I could find wisdom, I might be happy. This is long before, quite a long time before Buddhism. So in the back of my mind from then on, there was this idea of search for wisdom, search for wisdom. By the time I got to 14, I'd dumped Christianity after a sort of brief flirtation. And later in my early 20s, I did join an order, but it wasn't the Western Buddhist Order or the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order. It was the International Order of Kabbalists, would you believe? Now, this may sound as if I was pretty bright, but no, forget all about that. I was working class, quite poor family, East London. The way I've been summing it up in the last few years is that I was gormless, naive, emotionally blocked, and very, very confused. Very confused. For the foreigners amongst you, so to speak, or the non-English speakers, gormless, I looked this up because it's quite an interesting derivation. Gormless comes from an old Norse word meaning heed, so in the sense of to pay close attention, as in the English expression, take heed, you know, be careful, be mindful. So somebody who's gormless is heedless, stupid, and dull. There's also, apparently, a North English dialect word, gorm, which means a foolish person. And I could relate to that as well in my early days, quite directly. Not long after getting into Kabbalah, I got interested in Buddhism, and quite by chance, I met somebody called Alex Kennedy. Quite by chance, complete fluke. Alex Kennedy, for those of you who don't know, was Subhuti, and I think he'd been ordained about 2.5, maybe 3 years by the time I met him. This was in 1973, long before some of you were born, judging by looking at the sheets, the feedback sheets. 1973, I was about 25 years old, and meeting Subhuti struck me really strongly. It was my first brush with Buddhism in a sort of secular kind of intellectual kind of way. But Subhuti was really on the ball. And I thought to myself at the time, whatever this man's into, I want. I want what he's got. Took me a long time to work out that I didn't want all of it. And I certainly didn't have the capacity for quite a lot of it. I'd always moved in predominantly male circles from quite a young age. I had a very strong relationship with my father, very strong and positive relationship with my father, and a very difficult relationship with my mother. And Subhuti was by far the most friendly man I'd ever met. And at the same time, he didn't want anything from me. I found this quite startling and surprising. I'd never met anybody quite like him. He was so friendly, so full of information and helpful, and just gave to me. So that was my first brush really with the movement. And then I realised when I got home, I was living in Finsbury Park, and I realised that there was a centre in Archway, North London. And I started to meet other order members. And again, I was pretty impressed because all of them were pretty much themselves, and they also had a certain something that I'd never really encountered before. I don't think I had any concept of the order, But I found out quite early on that it wasn't, as we say in English again, all a bed of roses. You know, it wasn't all plain sailing and nice. One time, we used to do, in the old days, we used to do jumble sales. And one morning I got picked up by in the Archway Purple Transit van to collect jumble with Sabuti and Carmela Sheila. They were both order members by then. And as I got into the cab, you know, it was three seats in the front of the transit, I realised that they were having a flaming row. They were having this really sort of strong argument. So I just sort of looked out the window, you know. So I thought, well, this is interesting. Yeah. A bit later on, I met Bante. And I had a car at the time. I was probably the only person in the movement who did have one. It was the only vehicle apart from the purple van. And I ended up driving Bante, Sabuti, and the then Vajra Kumara to the old fire station in Bethnal Green, which was a crumbling and partly burnt out building, quite a big building, to see if it would make a good Buddhist centre. So that was quite interesting as well, because I was listening to them talking, and Bante had, you know, and Sabuti obviously had quite a sort of strong vision of, you know, looking at this charred room, you know, saying, oh yeah, this could be the shrine room. And you know, I was thinking, wow, that's interesting. And I ended up eating my first Indian curry. I was working class, and it was, you know, the early 70s, in the curry house in Euston, Bante's favourite. I can't remember what it's called.
Diwanis.
It was Diwanis, yeah. It was the first time I'd ever eaten an Indian curry. And it wasn't too bad, actually. And Bante was amazing. He was very interesting. I suppose in those very early days, I had a growing sense that, this is it. This is it. I'd wanted from quite a young age an open life. I didn't want a conventional life. I didn't want a conventional career. I didn't want a family. I was quite clear of that. I mean, maybe that's why I thought I was an orphan, and I was looking at my parents making a complete mess of it and thinking, God, you know, there's got to be another way of doing things than this. And I also wanted a life of practice. I wanted a life of practice. I wanted to be trying to be a good person 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I wasn't looking for a Buddhist hobby. I was quite certain about that. That's one of the reasons I dropped Christianity. I used to go to church on a Sunday. I got confirmed, but then I realised by Sunday I could be holy, but by Monday morning I'd forgotten it all, and it had all gone out the window. There was no practice. There was nothing to do. No way of continuing to practice. So I dumped it. So not long after meeting Bante going to the old fire station, I moved there with Sabuti and others to what is what is now the East London Buddhist Centre, they call it, yeah, and Sukhavati. In those days we called it Sukhavati. So this was 1974, I think, and I was 25 or 26, and I started living communally with order members, mitras, friends, and all sorts of weird and wonderful people who were just coming through the door off the streets, volunteering their services to help us with this massive job of converting this old fire station. It was a very rich and interesting time. Very enjoyable, and often at times painful as well. And I started during this period to realise just how gormless, naive and blocked and confused I actually was. I really started to get a strong sense of that. I mean, there are all sorts of stories I could tell about Sukhavati, but one sort of little one. Sabuti kept telling me, so I'm still, I think I was a mitra with Kalyana mitras. I asked Sabuti and Hridaya to be my Kalyana mitras, head and heart, which is an interesting combination. People told me I'd really chosen well with those two. That's it. But Sabuti started saying to me, he was saying to me, there's something you're not doing. there's something you're not doing. And I couldn't see what it was. I would say to him, no, I'm fine. I'm practicing. I'm doing this. I'm working. It's not, what's the problem? And then around this time, I don't know, I've never made this connection before, but I think they might be connected. Around this time, I had a conversation with Arya Mitra, who's an Alder member who died quite a number of years ago now. He had a sort of brain tumour, which eventually killed him. But I can remember very strongly this conversation from an Alder member. I don't think I was an Alder member at this point. I think, as I say, this was when I was not trying to think about asking for ordination. And Arya Mitra said to me, in the end, it's your life. You have to decide for yourself what you want to do. Nobody else can tell you. They can't make the decision. It's your decision. Effectively, you know, like, you've got to take responsibility for yourself. Doesn't matter what other people want you to do. You've got to do what you want to do. And it was a brilliant piece of advice, and I've never forgotten it. And it saw me in very good stead in subsequent years. Anyway, not long after, I think, having this conversation with Arya Mitra, Subhuti drove me up to Albemarle, which is a village in North Norfolk, where Banti was staying, to ask Banti for ordination. And I think that's what I wasn't doing. Things were very different in those days. You had to sort of ask Banti directly. There's a long story to this, but it would take far too long to tell you. It's very, very interesting and funny, and Banti was very interesting and funny in it. I mean, when I actually asked him, we went on this long walk. He used to go for these massive walks. In this one, it was we were in the pouring rain, and there was only one umbrella, so he had the umbrella, and I got completely soaked. And during this walk, I said to him, I went, Banti, I've been thinking of asking for ordination. And he said, yes, I think it's about time. And I thought, what? So I don't know, maybe they, you know, maybe I tried to find out after I was ordained, you know, what my feedback was and all that sort of thing from other order members, but nobody would tell me a thing. I never ever got to find out. In August 1976, I came to Padmaloka, which was newly acquired, for the Precious Garland Seminar with Bante, which I was on with Hridaya and a number of others. I don't know whether were you on that, Purn, or not? No. Attila and Punya were on that, if you know who they are. And at the last weekend of that, I was ordained privately in what is now the Redon Room, you know, the sort of out the front of the house, and publicly by the tea urn in the lounge. Yeah, great fun. Not long after that, I went on my first convention, my first order convention. Now, it might even have been in 1976. I think it might have been. It was a Sufi place called Four Winds. Anyway, that was quite interesting. I spent a lot of the free time on my own. Everybody paired up and went for walks, and it's like, you know, I'd end up in this room on my own. They'd all gone off. But it was all right, you know. I felt like I'd come home. I'd found my people, and I did enjoy that convention quite a lot. One of the things I thought about it, and again, this made quite a strong impression on me, was it was a bit like a really good party without the fishing. Now, I've never been very interested in parties. I've always found them very painful affairs, and I was telling my group about this morning. My analogy for the usual party, you know, the mixed sex job, was that you get a room full of people with a fishing rod with a fly on the end or some sort of lure, and they're all going like this to each other. They're sort of, but not one of them, everybody in the room sort of trying their lure out and everybody else. So you end up with this great tangle of sort of fishing lines that are all pulling away and hooking each other. And I used to think, God, this is horrible, you know. I don't want anything to do with this. I really didn't like parties. But the order convention wasn't like that. I stayed living and working at Sukhavati for about 3 years. It might have been a bit longer than that, right up until just about when it opened. During that time, and I think this is in 1979, I was doing a lot of yoga with Lokamitra, Iyengar yoga with Lokamitra. And in 79, in the autumn winter, we went to India to do a month with Mr. Iyengar in Pune. That started off being quite simple, quite a simple thing, you know, to do. Lokamitra put us through the mill, you know. I mean, he drove us for about 6 months, you know, in our yoga practices. We really worked very hard because he was terrified of being in front of Mr. Iyengar. Because what Mr. Iyengar used to do was, if you made a mess of a pose, he'd say, "Who is this teacher?" Right, and then he'd lay into the teacher. He wouldn't lay into the person. So, you know, Lokamitra was so he really drove us. And in some ways, I think he was worse than Mr. Iyengar. But anyway, I mean, it sounded quite simple. We'd just go there, we'd do a month with Mr. Iyengar, and then we'd come home. But then Banti suggested that to Lokamitra that he visit some of his, Banti's old contacts in India before we went to Pune. Now, again, this is a really long, interesting, and amazing story that I really haven't got time to go into. It's so long and complicated with all sorts of twists and turns. But to keep it simple and to sum up, India for me was a complete blast. It was a real blast. All the people that I went with, which included some alder members, other alder members, all the people that I went with, as soon as we landed, they all went slightly crazy. They all became very unpredictable and a bit mad. The only thing that remained constant from before, during and after going to India was my Manjugosha sadhana. That's the only thing that stayed the same. That's the practice I took from Banti when I was ordained. Everything else, everyone else, went completely wobbly. I got massive culture shock going in, and I got massive culture shock coming out. But there was more to it than that, even. The main result for me of being in India, for 2 months it was, actually, was I fell madly in love with a woman. India took the lid off my blocked emotions, especially in the area of sexuality. Fortunately, I didn't do anything about it while I was in India, so I didn't make a complete fool of myself or sort of embarrass the order in any way. But India really took the... And I suppose Mr. Iyengar as well. We did all these backbends. I mean, that I've got some photos of... some very interesting photos of us all in this room with Mr. Iyengar. And most other people are doing really sort of amazing poses. And I'm sort of... He ignored me the whole time, which I was very pleased about. I mean, he could have just come and he kicked and slapped people, but he didn't touch me. He used to sort of go, almost as if to say, "What is this jerk doing in my class?" I was so stiff. Now, before I went to India, whilst I was at Sukhavati, and I think this was even before I was ordained, I came to the conclusion that this spiritual life would be relatively easy, except for one thing. All I had to do was sort out what part women and sex had in my life. All I had to do. And I thought if I could sort that out, the rest would be easy. Sorting it out was and is another long story, for which I don't have a lot of time. However, just to cut it really short, I did end up running off in pursuit of women to France for about 9 months. Oh, there is a little bit that I forgot to write in here. So I was working at Sukhavati, and I'd fallen madly in love with this woman who lived down on the south coast, Brighton, well, near Brighton. And one day I went in to see Subhuti in the office at Sukhavati, and I said to him, "Subhuti, I'm leaving." He said, "All right, when are you leaving?" And I told him. He said, "Fine." I said, "Is that it?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "Don't waste too much time." And that was it. So I thought, God, I got off really lightly there, except that "don't waste too much time" was running around in the back of my brain like billio. Quite how long I did waste, I'm not too sure. I think it was about 9 months. Again, loads of stories for that, but I won't tell you any of those. When I came back, I turned up. In those days, older weekends were sort of we'd all get together I think now it's the first reception room at the LBC. I mean, things were that small. And sometimes it was the big hall down the road, which we don't have anymore. But you'd all sit round and you'd report in live, and then a string of people would take notes on sort of your reporting in and get them typed up, and they'd come out as Shabda, and there'd be all sorts of arguments. Oh, no, I didn't say that, I said this. Oh, you misrepresented me. There was all that sort of stuff. But so I came to this order weekend out of the blue and sat there. And as people reported in, it must have been several people said, God, it's so good to see Surita back. It's really good to see Surita back. And I just thought, well, that's great. Whatever I want to do, I don't have to run away and do it anymore. I can do it and stay in, kind of thing. So I really enjoyed that. It was like I was embraced, welcomed and embraced by the order as it then was. So that would have been, I'm not quite sure. I mean, around this time, there was, I've looked it up because I've got a copy upstairs. There was, I mean, we used to be the FWBO. So there was an FWBO newsletter that came out in autumn 1980 called Fierce Friendship. And on the cover, there's this red demon's face going, kind of thing, really sort of fierce. And this resulted in a period where aggressive criticism could pass for positive and constructive feedback. The emphasis was on fierce. Friendship often was lacking. I've always been of a fairly positive and optimistic nature. And I can remember two or three times, I think just before and just after I was ordained, two or three times an order member would take me to one side and he'd say, you know, there's something really dark in there. And one day it's going to come up and you're going to have a hell of a time. It never did. Well, not from inside. It came from outside. I did have my struggles. But as I say, not much of it had to do with me, as far as I can tell, unless I was still extremely blocked. I mean, there was another occasion where I better watch out for the names, isn't it? This is being recorded. I ended up in Brighton. I pursued this woman down to Brighton, and I ended up in Brighton teaching yoga and not much else, probably for about at least a year, with an order member who's sort of running the place more or less on his own. And he always used to say, "You know, Surita, you could be doing so much more." And I'd say, "Yeah." I just do my yoga classes. And then one night we went for it. He said he had some feedback for me. So we went for a walk. I don't know if you know Brighton, but there's this hill called the Race Hill. And on the top of the Race Hill, there used to be all these allotments. So we ended up in the allotments at about sort of, I don't know, it must have been 9 o'clock at night in the dark, having this sort of raging argument. And he said, "Oh, have you drummed out of the order, Surita?" And then I went home one way and he went home the other way. Even though we were living in the same community. I did have an interesting time in Brighton. And it is worth bearing in mind. I've given this talk. Where's the reference for it? I've given a talk on what is the order retreat, actually, in February 2010. Do look it up and listen to it. It's called The Life of an Order Member. I'll just do a brief quote from that. I said to people, and then I said, in your order career, when you get there, there will be blood and some of it will be yours. And I think that's the fact of the matter. I mean, you will fall out with people. People will fall out with you. What's important, I think, is how you respond to that and learning how to deal with conflict, learning how to deal with conflict. At one point, I was living in what do we call it? Amytias, which is where the center was, and I was the only man in the community with a whole load of there was an older alder member plus a load of very newly ordained people, men, and I was the only one with a girlfriend. And then, horror of horrors, and they already found this very difficult. They didn't like this at all. I wouldn't say there was pressure, but there was a definite vibe about, you know, what the hell do you think you're doing, kind of thing. And then she conceived. She conceived. So then I became absolutely the black sheep. I mean, people would only talk to me to give me really heavy feedback about, you know, leaving her, getting rid of the baby, clearing off somewhere else. It was very, very strong. I was literally on my own. What saved me, I think, was that I was in strong contact with a whole load of senior alder members who were very, very good. Sabuti, Nagabodi, Vasantara come to mind. I was actually on a winter retreat when I got the phone call from this girlfriend saying, "Oh, I'm pregnant." But she said, "It's all right." She was a trainee doctor. She said, "It's all right. I've said it all up. I'm going to have an abortion." And I said, "Well, I'm not sure about that." But anyway, that was the end of that conversation. So then I went to the team meeting and I said, "Look, this is what's happened." And they all said, "Oh, no, you better go down there and sort it out." So I left this retreat for about 4 days and went down and talked to her about it. And basically, I talked her into not having an abortion. However, I'm not a father because after about 2 and a half months, she miscarried. So that's as close as I've got to becoming a father. It's interesting, maybe I should watch this. somebody asked me whether I felt any grief about that. And I don't think I did. It's not that I didn't regret what had happened, because I think once we got over the fact that, you know, we were, a pregnant couple, and once I got over the idea, okay, yes, I'm going to be a father, I found a tremendous release of energy came up. And I just decided, oh, well, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to have to change my direction. And because I hadn't worked for some years, I was almost unemployable. So the idea was that we'd role reverse. I'd look after the child and she'd go out and earn the money, kind of thing. It didn't come to that in the end. As I say, I didn't exactly feel grief. Again, I've always been of a rather sort of, maybe, I don't know, philosophical, stoic nature. You know, it's just what happened. That's just the way it happened. We're going to have a child? No, we're not going to have a child. Okay, fair enough. What do we do next? However, what that left me with was a tremendous amount. I still had this tremendous amount of energy. And up until this point, I think, in Brighton, I've been largely... again, the way I describe it to myself is swanning around having cups of tea with lots of nice people all day long, basically, and signing on. That's what I was doing. And then teaching a few yoga classes. That's why this senior older member used to say to me, "You could be doing so much more, Surita, than drinking cups of tea and teaching yoga." Where was I? Yeah, so... Once the baby was no more, and I wasn't going to be a father, the heat came off me. They stopped having a go at me. I'm just trying to think what my experience was like. It was almost like, they just sort of, it went back to the way it was when I just had the girlfriend, really. They just kept out of my, I think they kept out of my way in case they caught something. That was a bit what it was like. And then very quickly after that, the regime, as I call it sometimes, completely collapsed. Most of them left and went on to sow wild oats of their own all over the place, which I thought was a bit rich. Most of them apologised to me, which I thought was pretty good going, actually. Anything else about Brighton? Once all this energy had come up, I spent, I don't know what it was probably about 3 or 4 years, I really started to get stuck in. I mean, it's almost as if I mean, I said I was gormless and all the rest of it. In those days, there wasn't a lot of training. So although I got the case, I didn't really know what I was supposed to be doing. I didn't really have a clue about anything. But once, with all this energy, I just sort of poured it back into my life and work at the centre. So I became the men's and the women's Mitra convener, men's and women's Mitra study. All sorts of interesting stories I could tell you about that, but it'll have to be another time. So I just really got stuck into things. Oh, and I used to come here. This is before I moved here. I used to come here 3 times a year. I'd do a winter retreat, an Easter retreat, and a summer retreat. And I did that for about 3 or 4 years through the beginning of the 80s, I think. I had quite a difficult time with the mitras in Brighton, certainly the men mitras. The women mitras were fine. They were so appreciative. There were never any arguments with them. But the men, most of them became order members in due course. But the men, it was a bit like going in to face a pack of wolves every night. And I never knew whether they were just going to savage me or savage each other and tear each other to bits. And I thought, well, there must be something I could do about this, you know, to sort of learn how to do this and prepare myself. So I went on a two-year non-residential counselling course, which was very interesting. I really enjoyed that. I was the only Buddhist there. Nobody else was a Buddhist. But one of the things that I learned from that, and I even think it was like a little insight, was that basically everybody's experience, emotional experience, is the same, more or less. Some people have difficult times, some people have easy times. But their general sort of view of how the world is and all the rest of it was more or less the same. And that struck me very strongly on this course with these other people. 1988, I think I'd gone on, I went on, that's it, my friend Ratnaguna went on the first Tuscany, which was in 1981, so this is going back a little bit. And Ratnaguna is a very dear friend of mine. We lived in a community together when we were both beginners in Archway, and I had another one of these I Want That experiences. Ratnaguna came back from Tuscany 81 on fire. It's like his intellect and his mind had been really sort of sparked off. And I thought, I want that. So I went on Tuscany 82. But I'm not sure whether I had an intellect in those days. I didn't have a very easy time. I mean, again, there are all sorts of stories I could tell you about that. It was wonderful being on retreat with Bhante, because Bhante came on some of those early things. And generally speaking, the order team was very good. We had our difficulties in all sorts of ways, but I began to get the sense of what Bhante was trying to do with the order and with ordinations, because he said to us, okay, I want you all to talk about these people and tell me whether you think they're all ready for ordination. And there was one man who I was sort of supporting, really, who we couldn't decide about. One person, well, Arya Mitra, actually, the person who gave me that amazing feedback in the earlier in Sukhavati, he said, no, I can't agree to this man being ordained. Everybody else thought he was ready. So we went back to Bhante and we said, look, we all think he's ready except Arya Mitra. And he said, well, if you can't agree completely, I can't ordain him. So it was I found it a real blow. This guy, I think, lost complete faith and confidence in me. I think that was the end of our sort of friendship, and he disappeared after that. So it wasn't an easy time. Also, I didn't have any Italian. So this is down in Tuscany, those Tuscany retreats down in Tuscany, and I had to go out and do shopping, which was quite a hoot. I can remember one time. I had to go and talk to these two women, so I got the address, and I had to go and talk to these two women about giving us some big gas cylinders to fill up. So I sort of knocked on the door, and I went in, and they said something to me in Italian, and I said, no. And they looked at each other and said, sit down, you know, kind of thing, and I sat down, and They kept sort of looking at each other and twiddling their fingers. And then I said, look, gas cylinders. And they said, oh, right, okay. That's what they'd said to me. They'd said to me, do you want gas cylinders? That's the only reason I'd be there. But it took about half an hour of me sort of, and them as well. It was quite a difficult encounter. I got my gas cylinders and all the rest of it. Pardon? So that made a diff. That started off this sort of surge of energy thing as well. That fed into that. So I really did put myself into the Brighton Centre for probably about 6 or 7 years. I was there for about 9 years altogether. What else can I tell you about? I also went on a number of Gukhiloka retreats. That's it, Gukhiloka ordination retreats. I think I've done about five, and I think I led two, something like that. But on one of these, this is an interesting. I think you'll find this an interesting little story. Banti was on this course, and you could ask to go and see him. So I went down to see him, and I mean, again, it was a very funny encounter. But at a certain point, he got me to sit down, and he sat facing me. But he sat me down so that he had his back to the wall, and there was a window over the top with the sun beaming in, and I was sitting in the sunlight, kind of thing. So I could hardly see him, and I had this thing. Subhuti had always been going on about, I'm trying to work myself into a position where I can do whatever Banti asked me to do. So I sort of stumbled out with a falsetto almost. Is there anything you think I want to be doing, Banti? Kind of thing. Do you think there's anything I should be doing? And Banti said, what about more Dharma study? Oh, I do lots of Dharma study, Banti. I don't think... And he just dropped it completely. He dropped the subject completely, and we talked about something else. And then about 2 days later, Subhuti strode up to me and he said, you've got to do more Dharma study. So, in a way, Subhuti was my sort of direct teacher, in a sense. Oh dear, right, I'm going on a bit, aren't I? 1988, Subhuti, well, when I got back from Tuscany, I said to Subhuti, I realised being on retreat for 3 months, I think it was only 3 months, that this was me at my best. Being on retreat was me at my best. And as I say, I went on to lead retreats here. And I just really enjoyed the retreat life, suited me down to the ground. So I'd said to Subhuti after Tuscany 82, look, if ever you need anybody for the team for a long ordination retreat, I'm your man. And he said, well, at the moment, we can't do that. There's no, unless you can provide the funds, we can't support you to do it. Later, this changed. And I think he sort of remembered this, because when he decided with Banti to sort of rejig the ordination process, and well, and set up the ordination process here, he said to me, would you like to come and be on the team at Padmaloka? And I took my time with this decision. I'd been in a right livelihood, so-called, in Brighton, which was difficult, to say the least. So I was very sort of very hesitant about, I mean, I sort of, it's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be on retreat all the time, but I knew it was going to be quite a sort of tight situation, and I was a little bit worried about that. And in the end, I came up here on an order weekend, I think in maybe in August or something like that, and Banti, I got this message, oh, Banti wants to see you in his study, which is now my room. So I went in to see Banti, and he said, all right, he said, let's tie you down. When are you moving to Padmaloka? I said, October, Banti. Good, I'll see you then, kind of thing. And that was me, that was out. I have a mind of my own sometimes, I'm afraid. So I moved to Padmaloka, and really it was probably, after ordination, it was probably one of the best things I've ever done. For me, it was perfect. I was on retreat a lot. I had to do loads and loads of study over and over again, the same thing, which is perfect because I'm a really slow learner. So I've done the Transcendental Principle, I don't know, it must be something like 28 times. I've done most of those early themes at least 25 times, some of them 28 times. And I love them as much now as ever I did then. I still get stuff out of them. It's amazing. As you read stuff and study stuff, you change. And then the next time you read it and study it, because you're different, you get more out of it again. I'm a firm believer in repetition over and over. And it, as I say, it suits me down to the ground. Not only that, but I came here and lived with an amazing bunch of people. I mean, initially it was Subhuti, Chittapala, a Mexican order member called Shudavadra, who's since resigned, and me. There were four of us on the team, and we did everything. By the time I got here, they'd been going for, I think, 6 months, just the three of them leading retreats for 6 months between them. And that's doing everything. I mean, now we've got a 15-man ordination team and support team to do that stuff. So when I got here, they were all completely spent by the time I got here. So they just said to me, right, you lead everything in the shrine room, because they just weren't up to it anymore. And then gradually we sort of got more people in. That was wonderful. Sona joined us, Suvadra joined us, Arloka joined us, Padmavadra joined us. I mean, it was like the sort of the dream team, really, the super group almost of friends in the good life. It was wonderful, and continues to be so, really. During that time, by turns, I became a private preceptor. There wasn't a process. You didn't have to be asked by somebody in those days. I just got the nod. You know, I think both times Suvadra came up to me and he said, "Banji says you're a private preceptor now." All right, okay. And then I was on a Gukhyaloka course and he came up and he said, "Ah, now you're a public preceptor." and then a bit later again, I became an eighth of the head of the order. I really didn't know, in some respects, I really didn't know what I was doing. I certainly didn't know what I was doing there. I remember my first, it was the beginnings of the public preceptors college, really. I said to Subhuti, you know, I sat there were only about eight of us, I think, and I said to Subhuti, I didn't particularly want to be here. He said, "That's exactly why we wanted you." Because there were loads of people who really wanted to be part of the public preceptors college. And he said, "We don't want any of them." So then I was made eighth of the head of the order. Just a little story to do with that. It was around this time that I'd always thought, it's interesting how one's sort of development goes, isn't it? I'd always thought that I was an extrovert. My dad was an extrovert, really an extrovert. And I just thought, well, that's what you do. If you're a man, you do that. So I learned extroversion from him. And somehow I managed to keep it all together. But around this time, we did some work with people on Myers-Briggs. And I realised I was an introvert. Quite a strong introvert, actually. And it's like, ooh. And it sort of gave me permission to, almost to spend more time on my own and get into my own world in a positive kind of way, which I hadn't done before that. So when it came to eighth of the head of the order, there we are we're in Birmingham, in the town hall, I think it was, wasn't it? And Banji said, "Oh, this is what I'm going to do. I think you can listen to it all on tape." And then Subhuti responded. We'd already talked about this. We knew it was going in that direction and that we'd probably end up, although what it meant, we really didn't know. We didn't know what it would mean to be head of the order. But we ended up with Banti on stage, and then Sabuti saying, "Right, well, let's have the others up on stage." So we all end up on stage, and there's this hall. I don't know how big Birmingham Town Hall is, but it was huge, and it was full of people, most of whom I didn't know. But I suddenly realised they know who I am by name. And this horrified me. It absolutely horrified me. And when I got back to Padmaloka, I went into Norwich one day, and we used to have a Windhorse shop in Norwich. And if I was feeling a bit introverted, because I was getting into my introversion, man. And if I was feeling introverted, I'd sort of look in the shop, and if there was nobody in there that I knew, I'd go in and have a little cruise around. If there was somebody in there I knew, I thought, no. I don't feel like it today, so I'd wander off. So this one day I went in, there was nobody I knew, so I went in, and I could see them all behind the counter going, they knew who I was. I didn't know who they were, but they knew who I was, and they probably could remember my name as well. And again, I thought, God, I hate this, this is terrible. However, we didn't stay the head of the order for very long, fortunately. I wonder whether I should stop there. I did have a few, not exactly words of advice, but little tips, I suppose. Today we were talking in my group about knee-jerk words. Do you know what these are? So they're words where, you know, if I say to you, oh, you might be a disciple of mine or Bante's, it's like, disciple? I'm not a disciple, I don't want to be a disciple. And one of these words is institution, you know, the institutions of the movement. And I know some people go institutions, organisations, you know, order, I don't want that. But I would suggest, it's just a little piece of advice, that if you cannot survive or even thrive in the institutions of the movement, in the widest sense, at least to some extent, perhaps the spiritual life, the real spiritual life, isn't for you. And I think you need to think about that quite sort of strongly. Yeah, the institutions of the movement make things happen. Yeah, they make things happen. They ensure that there's a Kalyana Mitrata, that metta comes into play, yeah, that people are ordained in a sort of reasonable and sensible manner, and we don't make too many mistakes at it, yeah, and it's all because of the institutions of the movement. Without that, we'd be a band of mindless vagabonds, I think, frankly. I keep reminding myself all the way through for quite a long time, actually. I think since Tuscany 82, I periodically remind myself what Banti means by spiritual. You know, if I'm trying to live the spiritual life, what does he actually mean by that? So I'm not going to tell you what that is. Look it up in the Essential Sangharakshita, page 294. And he tells you exactly what he means by spiritual. And it draws a definite line. If you're not above that line, you may be leading some sort of life with some interesting little, you know, Buddhist dalliances here and there, but it is not a spiritual life. Yeah, he means something very definite by that. There were all sorts of things I was going to tell you, but I'll give you one more. Yeah, just one more. I suggest that you specialise. Yeah, you specialise in your movement career, and by that I mean become a Sangharakshita expert. Read everything that he's written, everything, yeah? Watch all the videos and the DVDs, listen to all the tapes and CDs. What we're finding more and more on the Older Nation team is that there are great chunks of sort of basic Buddhism that was on at our fingertips and sort of, you know, common knowledge back, you know, like 30 years ago, and people have just missed it. And I think it's because they're not reading Banti, they're not listening to him, and they're not watching him, yeah? I mean, there's all sorts of stuff out there, but frankly, there isn't a lot of time, yeah? Life is short. You need a sense of urgency. And Banti himself would say that, really, there's only time for the best. So I suggest that the best is Sangharakshita. Watch him, read him, listen to him, and chuck everything else out. Yeah, chuck everything else out because it's almost a waste of time. That'll do.